the pandemic has really shown that broadband is just like electricity and just like water. You really need it these days to survive.
In most regions of the country, childcare is the most expensive part of a family's budget.
There was no way I was going to be able to ever afford daycare.
So why is the country's broadband infrastructure still not reliably connecting rural communities?
And so one of the things we must do, and I know that Joe will do as president, we need to expand broadband so that every student in this country has access to the internet.
From today's bills to tomorrow's jobs,
we're looking for the government at work in our tap water, light switches, bridges, and broadband.
You're listening to Pantsuit Politics Summer Series,
Infrastructure in Real Life.
Everyone, and welcome back to our Infrastructure in Real Life series here at Pantsuit Politics. Over the past three episodes, we've talked about huge pieces of American infrastructure, systems that have been in place for decades, if not centuries, in one form or another. We've learned about how vital those systems are, where they need attention and maintenance, and what the future may hold for them.
What we've not discussed yet is the infrastructure of the 21st century. The infrastructure emerging as necessary to the structures of our culture and economy, but around which we haven't built much. So we're going to try to tackle two of those areas today, broadband and childcare. And we know that specifically talking about childcare as infrastructure is controversial. But as we have put together these episodes, I know I personally, Sarah, have become more convinced that that's an appropriate label for childcare, because I feel like we've spent a lot of time thinking about what is infrastructure and what is the point of it. And my conclusion has become that infrastructure is our best way of showing care for each other. It is our way of saying these particular elements are so foundational to the way that we live, and they are so difficult and challenging and not profitable ways to do in a just way that we have to pitch in together and find some supports and some balance of connectedness and also customizing based on regions of the United States and those regions' needs. And I think childcare fits pretty well under that umbrella.
Have you ever experienced a dry, itchy scalp or ever wondered why your color isn't lasting as long as your hairdresser promised? Well, unfiltered, mineral-filled water could be the reason why. Did you know hard water is a leading cause of damaged hair and dry, irritated skin? And that about 85% of the United States uses hard water, filled with dissolved minerals and added chlorine. That's where Canopy's new filtered showerhead comes in. Canopy, known for their beauty hacks and reimagined humidifier, has revolutionized the filtered showerhead. Dermatologists recommended this unique three-stage filtration system greatly reduces contaminants and odors in your shower water, leaving you with healthy hair and glowing skin. Best of all, the Canopy filtered showerhead is hassle-free. Installation is a breeze. We put it in, it took like 30 seconds, guys. And its unique quick-release filter replacement feature allows for seamless filter replacement unlike any others on the market. Go to getcanopy.co to save $25 on your Canopy filtered showerhead purchase today with Canopy's hassle-free filter subscription. Even better, our listeners can use code PANTSUIT at checkout to save an additional 10% off your Canopy purchase. Hurry, your hair and skin will thank you.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? Mine is at about 50%, and I'll tell you why. I have a tendency to overcommit. I want to help with everything I can possibly help with. I want to do everything I can possibly do. I want to be with people, and I forget that at the end of the day, I am an introvert, and I really need time to recharge and take care of myself. Therapy gives me important tools to do that, to recognize what's going on, to understand my battery and where it is and why it's there and what I can do to recharge. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/pantsuit today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/pantsuit. So that I do not like to spend my time or money in salons when I can help it, but I do enjoy a good manicure, and I especially enjoy spending time with my daughters doing the Olive and June Mani system at home, because we can all get a good looking manicure for around $2. We know that the polish won't chip and will last at least a full week. We get to await with anticipation the new colors that come out each season. The girls love being able to add some sparkles or choose whether they want their top coat to be matte or shiny. We just have a really good time together with salon grade tools that are so easily explained so that we can do a really good job taking care of our nails, but do it all from the comfort at home. All the choices of a big salon stored in a basket in my closet for when we're ready to hang out together. The Olive and June Mani system is a real game changer. So visit oliveandjune.com/pantsuit for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/pantsuit for 20% off your first Mani system.
So we're going to make the case in the second half of the show that childcare is infrastructure. But before that, we're going to tackle a topic that fits more naturally into our traditional definitions of infrastructure, broadband. And even though providing broadband involves physical infrastructure, pipes, tunnels, poles, we are still a very long way from making it accessible and reliable to millions of Americans.
So let's start at the beginning. Understanding that America has always had some kind of communications infrastructure. We began with written communication with the founding of the United States Post Office. This actually predated our Constitution and made its way into the Constitution. And then Ben Franklin oversaw its creation as a head of department for a short while.
That's old Ben's second appearance in the series, which I think makes him our founding father of U.S. infrastructure. In the mid-1800s, we saw a new communication technology taking off, and the United States laid thousands of miles of telegram lines to speed the transmission of communication.
Then in the early 1900s, radio transmission enters the scene, and suddenly we're able to transmit audio communications instead of just text. But radio spectrum is finite, and so this is where we start to see government regulations. In 1927, we had the Radio Act establishing that radio waves are public property, and that means that radio stations have to have licenses from the government in order to use that spectrum. The government did decide not to charge stations for the use of this property.
And we're also seeing the dramatic growth of telephone communications. And suddenly, the federal government realizes growth is the name of the game when it comes to communications, and they need a new way to govern wire, radio, telephone communications. So they passed the Communications Act of 1934, which creates the Federal Communications Commission. And here's the language from that bill about what the FCC is supposed to do. It's for the purpose of regulating interstate and foreign commerce and communication by wire and radio so as to make available, so far as possible, to all the people of the United States a rapid, efficient, nationwide, and worldwide wire and radio communication service with adequate facilities at reasonable charges for the purpose of the national defense, for the purpose of promoting safety of life and property through the use of wire and radio communications, and for the purpose of securing a more effective execution of this policy by centralizing authority heretofore granted by law to several agencies, and by granting additional authority with respect to the interstate and foreign commerce and wire and radio communications. This is hereby created a commission to be known as the Federal Communications Commission, which shall be constituted as hereinafter provided and which shall execute and enforce the provisions of this act.
So we have telegrams, radio transmission, an ever-growing telephone network. And then in the 1980s, we start to see computer networks communicating with one another.
Nicole Turner Lee, Senior Fellow, Governance Studies, and Director of the Center for Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institution. many of us can think about the early days of telephones and how the early days of telephones were really our communication artery coming off of the telegraph. Telephone really transformed our communications infrastructure. Well, after the breakup of the baby bells, we began to see something called modems, which some folks might remember as AOL, you got mail. That then transitioned to copper wires, which was at that time considered DSL. Some people I actually understand still have DSL services where high-speed broadband has been harder to install, which is a faster version of DSL. And high-speed broadband basically allowed for more of the transmission of information services along, you know, now a variety of modalities. We're seeing satellite, we're seeing wireless, we're seeing cable services that are now complementing the ability to transmit broadband. At the end of the day, as an information service, what broadband is able to do compared to what we were able to see with the telephone line is it's not just able to transmit voice like we're talking now, but data.
Okay, so that history brings us to broadband. Broadband is transmitting data of all kinds, not just our voice, not just text. It's high-speed internet access that's able to be passed through a variety of physical modalities. We've got our layperson's definition, but considering that the government can be notoriously slow to understand and legislate around new technologies, we should probably check in on the government definition as well.
My name is Catherine DeWitt, and I am the project director for the Broadband Access Initiative at the Pew Charitable Trusts. When we talk about broadband in the context of policy, the Federal Communications Commission defines broadband speeds, broadband internet speeds, as being 25 megabits per second download and 3 megabits per second upload. Technically, it is sufficient for one person in a household to do what we're doing right now, which is, you know, rely on real-time audio and visual communication, send emails without any problem, and download information from the internet.
The fact that you downloaded this show from the internet likely means that you have an understanding of how impactful high-speed internet access can be. It's become ubiquitous to our daily lives and routines, and it's really interesting, like, this infrastructure's existence has created new forms of communications, not just facilitated them. This means that broadband is an increasingly vital part of Dr. Turner Lee's conception of our communications infrastructure.
And you may just think of your upload and download speeds impacting the refresh rate of your social media or your Netflix. But if the pandemic showed us anything, it's that those speeds are also affecting how students get online for school, how you engage in visits remotely with your healthcare providers, or how you collaborate with your coworkers across the country. It's not just about entertainment and how fast it's delivered to our house.
Just to personalize this for a second, the team that works on Pantsuit Politics works every day from 5 different states together. Every single aspect of this series has been put together across many more states without anyone ever being in the same physical room.
Just because the threat of COVID is fading, that doesn't mean that the trends the pandemic dramatically accelerated are going away. Over the past 2 decades, e-commerce grew from 1% to more than 16% of retail sales. Then in 2020, it doubled. We have 50% more telehealth visits, and 2/3 of those working from home say they'd like to continue to do so.
Even as most kids return to a brick-and-mortar classroom or folks opt to see physicians in person, having more options available has definitely shown us that our society can be more equitable for people with all sorts of reasons to need a virtual connection instead of a physical one. Basically, we're all using broadband so many ways every single day. And this is a relatively new phenomenon. It wasn't long ago at all that this kind of data transmission would have felt like a science fiction moment. The technology of data transmission has evolved really fast, and the next big evolution of 5G is at our doorstep.
The mobile device, in many respects, particularly the smartphone, is only about 11, 12 years old. And we started with mobile, where it was primarily SMS services, which is actually the platform for our text messaging that we do. But over time, what started out is, I call it no G, because there's still communities around the country that do not have any type of mobile access. We went to 2G, 3G. And I think the pivotal moment actually was 4G LTE, which allowed us to actually enable applications like ride sharing services. Now we have these devices that allow us to order ride sharing services, track the location of the particular transportation, be able to share that with somebody, and at the same time get into that vehicle and perhaps, you know, videotape your experience. But now we're going into something called 5G, which is going to have lower latency and high speeds that will allow us to enable not just our ride-sharing services, but precision medicine and telehealth services, where you could actually be within the comfort of your home in North Carolina and speak to a doctor in New York City, where they could do surgery without missing a beat in terms of the bandwidth. That's very new and it's more advanced. Obviously, there are challenges to make sure that everybody has access not just to the technology, but the technology itself will also demand a new device. And so some people out there listening may be getting these advertisements around get a 5G phone. That has a lot to do with the capability of that device to work along these advanced networks.
As we consider the next steps of ensuring broadband accessibility, we also need to remember the technologies that will follow quickly in broadband's footsteps and consider how we'll make them accessible as well. In our conversations with Adi Tomer, he explained why 5G will be an even greater challenge.
So 5G requires, and by the way, we are still at really early stages of not just 5G deployment, but figuring out exactly which kind of quote-unquote 5G we're going to use. In general, the wireless technology cannot go as far as the current quote-unquote 4G. And you probably, some people have, right, they have phones, it says 4G at the top, or it says LTE, it's the same idea. So because it can't go as far, we have to daisy chain all these towers, but much smaller towers. They call them small cells. And underneath, quite literally in the ground, or I mean, you could string it above ground if you wanted to, it has to have fiber pipes going between them, or what they call a fiber backbone. So by having all these small cells, you got to build a lot more of them in more places. So this is why 5G is not coming to rural America anytime soon.
While to many of us, access to broadband seems like a given, there are Americans who only have access to unreliable service or maybe no service at all. How many Americans? Well,
we don't know the answer to that question. That in and of itself is a fundamental problem. And it's less about how those connections are provided and more about how those connections are reported. So twice a year, internet service providers are required to submit something called Form 477 to the Federal Communications Commission. That form is designed to capture where broadband is either provided or could reasonably be provided throughout the country. The most recent reporting is just over 14 million Americans who don't have access to a connection. The challenge and why we get to that point of a lack of clarity as to how many Americans have it or don't have it is the fact that providers are reporting where they either provide service to a single address or could reasonably provide service to a single address within that census block. If one address within that census block is either connected or could be connected, that census block is considered served. More problematically, that also means that that census block is ineligible for federal funding.
Let's just take a second to recognize how wild it is by current standards that providing service just means that you could provide access to one address in an entire area. It doesn't necessarily mean that everyone on that census block is or could be connected with good quality service. We would never stand for that level of assessment with electricity or water running. So what do we do about this? Catherine points out that we really have two distinct problems to consider.
The first is the availability of those connections, and the second is the affordability of those connections. Where we see the positive impacts on communities, on individual households, on income, on unemployment, is when we factor in the level of adoption on people actually using the internet. But in order to use the internet, they have to be able to afford the internet.
I really don't think we can emphasize that enough. There are two components to broadband infrastructure: availability, the actual physical connectivity, and affordability, or an adoption gap, lack of affordable broadband or digital skills or other barriers that keep people from connecting.
So it's always important to center this conversation around how we actually use connections.
It's about creating opportunity in communities that have been left behind. You know, this often gets painted as an urban versus rural issue, and that's a disservice to a lot of communities across the country, because this is a challenge that affects communities of all types, all sizes, and all locations.
I love that framing of broadband as opportunity, because that's how we started the series, right? Is that the opportunity to grow and thrive and flourish in the United States, particularly economically, has always been built on a physical foundation of services, be it water, electricity, road service, and now broadband. How in 2021 someone could not see that as a foundation to any opportunity someone wants to pursue, particularly economically, but honestly, educationally or otherwise, is just mind-blowing to me.
We had Jason Kander on the podcast recently to talk about his military service, but as we were wrapping that conversation up, one of the things he said to us that has stuck with me, and I've thought about so much since then, was that he thinks what people really need from government is the opportunity to be happy, healthy, safe, and together.
I think that most of politics is about four things, and they all have to do with one thing, and that's your family. And what it is that people want four things for their family. They want their family to be happy, to be healthy, to be safe, and to be nearby. And every single political issue comes down to that. We're not that different on these issues. The problem is we got to recognize that when we're talking to people in the middle of the country or in the southern part of the country or in any rural-ish part of the country, we got to remember that what everybody's trying to do is make it so that their kids don't have to leave, so that they can be near their grandkids.
That together component has really been left behind in terms of brain drain from rural areas, large employers concentrating in major cities, and that we just need to understand how important it is for generations of families to feel like there is an opportunity to stay in their hometowns. And broadband, to me, is that major key to good jobs being available everywhere, to people being able to pursue whatever kind of education they want and still stay in proximity with the people who raised them and who love them if they want to do that. It makes me really excited to think about what society could look like. Even if I reflect on my own experience, you know, I graduated from high school in a very rural county, and I never believed that I would be able to stay in that county because of the job opportunities available there. And I think that has to already be different and will be so different 10, 20 years from now.
So there is the thread that infrastructure offers enormous opportunity. But another thread that we've been picking up throughout this series is that there is often, in fact, almost never, a silver bullet solution. And so broadband isn't that silver bullet either. It has enormous impact on our communities, but it can't solve everything, even if it does have really tangible impacts.
We know that getting the infrastructure in place is really the first step. Like, we often hear from lawmakers, candidly, at every level of government saying, you know, okay, if we get fiber, if we get broadband, you know, that's going to solve the opioids crisis. We can attract all these companies and, you know, we can, you know, keep our rural healthcare facility. And that's not necessarily true. But what we do know is that when that both infrastructure and that adoption plan is rolled into a broader economic development strategy, that's really where we see the impacts and being able to attract and retain businesses, to see sort of that boomerang effect of younger people moving back to the hometowns that they grew up in. People want that lifestyle. And now those communities have the internet connections to be able to support remote work, and that they're able to support their parents or aging members of their family, being able to facilitate connections with medical facilities, and just honestly being able to do simple things like, you know, shop online.
We need more people to understand that it has to be everywhere. I did studies years ago that when we look at where broadband goes, most states and cities look at it for tourism, right? It's a proved quality of life. It's like having a pool in a house where people want to move to places where there's broadband. But the economic upside, in addition to actually having it for people's ability to telework, Main Street America's ability to actually have broadband so that they can export their products or services out, farmers' ability to have broadband so they can engage in precision agriculture, potentially knowing when there's rainfall and when there's not, and when there's going to be a dry season. technology has always been used as a way to solve problems, social problems at that. And here we have people who have this resource within their pocket or purse in places where we have high rates of opioid addiction, in places where we have high rates of poverty, in places where people have no clue on how to get vaccinated or how to schedule an appointment to get vaccinated. And we have to start looking at whole communities going forward, because it's these whole communities that are going to be forced to move from in-person economies to those that are online. And governments serve to benefit when they can actually get their folks connected because they're able to get more things out. I mean, think about the early stages of SMS, text messaging. What did that do in places like Kentucky or other places? It allowed us to put out Amber Alerts when kids are, you know, missing. It allows us to share when major thunderstorms or tornadoes or hurricanes are coming to places. We need now to go to the next level, but we cannot do that if people do not have the access to broadband. It's not affordable to people across the board, and they're not convinced about why they should use it or adopt it. So this is not like an instance, again, where we have to be one size fits all. We need broadband so we can modernize our nation's infrastructure, and we can look at this as complementary to many of the goals where we as a country want to be digitally competitive.
So connecting everyone in an equitable way probably starts to sound expensive. And it is. Let's talk about those costs realistically. The numbers being kicked around Washington sound like a lot. When you look at what needs to be done, it still might not be enough money to make it all happen. And that money would be going to very specific places.
Your connection that you and I are both using in our homes or offices right now is what's called the last mile connection. That's the last piece of the network. But the middle mile, which is the part of the network that connects your community anchor institutions like schools and libraries, healthcare facilities, that part of the network carries a lot of data. It's a huge trunk line. You need more middle mile in the network in order, one, to bring down the cost of delivering last mile connections, but also to make sure that the quality of those connections are good. And we don't have a very firm understanding right now of how much middle mile is actually in the ground, what's available for use, and how much money needs to be invested in building out the middle mile.
It could cost $100 billion to solve availability, but half of that would be the final 2% of locations. And that will come with enormous maintenance costs the users couldn't possibly shoulder with just subscription fees. And the reality is that subscription fees are what is often covering the cost of access, which is why access is limited, because broadband connections are overwhelmingly provided by private sector entities whose focus is profit.
Communities may not always present an obvious business case for internet service providers. Maybe the provider decides the median income in that area is too low. Sometimes it's about geography and topography. Someone lives on top of a mountain, you know, rocky terrain that's extremely expensive to build through. There are just a lot of factors in place that influence a provider's decision to get these unconnected communities online. But that's where it's really important for us to have policies and programs in place to help address some of those challenges. What we found through our research is that in some cases, just a relatively small amount of public funding, $2-3 million, was enough to help a smaller regional provider or other provider say, you know what, yes, I can get this community online. We can make the math work.
In some cases, we're going to be able to bring into rural communities fiber. In other rural communities, we may not be able to do that because fiber has to be pulled and stretched and it has to be dug up and available. I was recently doing an interview, and one of the companies that was represented as part of the guest was a man that told us about how he had to put fiber optic cables on the back of a mule to get up the hills of the rocky Kentucky mountains to be able to string it. So that's one technology that will get the job done in terms of high-speed broadband connections. But then we're seeing this promise of 5G, where 5G has the potential to bring huge capacity to large swaths of land that may work out in certain communities in rural areas, and it may work to the advantage of densified urban spaces where you see more buildings than cows, where people need the same type of high-speed access.
So it's really expensive. It is inefficient to deliver it equitably. We've come across that over and over again. When we talk about water and electricity, there are places where it's going to cost an awful lot of money for not a lot of people, and we still have to do it. And that's really, I think, where we are with broadband. Sarah, you posed a question when the Biden administration first rolled out this $4 trillion infrastructure package that what does it cost or how do we pay for it is not the first question. The first question should be, is it worth it?
Yes. I think focusing on our purpose. You know, we talked a little bit about that when we were talking about climate change in another episode, that we need a vision. And I think in a lot of ways, because it's been so long since we've tackled big infrastructure projects, when we've had to figure out how to get electricity to everybody in America, we've lost our vision. We've lost the idea that efficiency is only a piece of the puzzle. Cost effectiveness is only a piece of the puzzle when we're talking about infrastructure and equity. You know, the biggest piece of the puzzle is that we come together to do hard things. That's why we're here. That's why we're together as this country. And we're not treating our citizens and other parts of the country as clients or customers and doing some cost-benefit analysis. That's why this is important for the government to step in, because they don't have to be driven by cost effectiveness or cost benefit ratios. It's not that that shouldn't be a piece of the puzzle. It should. But we have to keep in mind that vision, that we are here to do things together, that we are here to protect each other, that we are here because doing things together is better than trying to tackle it all individually and letting people get left behind. People that didn't just choose to move to the outer reaches of Alaska, right?
It's about community. Are you okay with the idea that there is some kid growing up who was born on, you know, in a small town or farm, because we're talking about rural areas, right? And because she or he was born there, they don't get to be on the internet.
We need to think about what is our social contract with people so that we ensure that schools don't have to wait around for 6, 7, 8 months to get a tablet to connect the kids to the internet.
So knowing that the economic success of all of our communities, particularly our small ones, depends on reliable high-speed internet access, thinking about how we actually bring all those interests together to get something done helps us understand that the government is going to have to be involved. You know, I'm a person who typically favors private sector solutions to problems. But as we see with both water and the electrical grid, our transportation systems, and now with broadband, there has to be an intersection of private and public interest to make these projects happen. It's too big of a lift to be done in just the private sector or just the public sector.
And we know right now that broadband is largely private industry.
One of the interesting things that has occurred in the last few years is that lawmakers are really viewing this less as a luxury and viewing it more as an essential service, this meaning internet connections. Interestingly, we saw that change happening more rapidly at the state level than we did at the federal level. And I think we are seeing more policymakers view this as an essential service because they're seeing the ramifications of what happens when those connections aren't available. They're seeing communities lose jobs, lose businesses. They're seeing population loss. You know, we had more than one official in our field research tell us, you know, if we didn't have this internet connection, like our town would die.
Dr. Turner Lee has really advocated for a tech New Deal, as you've heard her talk about in Willigan, and that it is important not to push the entire burden here to the public sector or the private sector, but that the public sector must take on a greater role. In part, we've talked about how we can't even put our arms around who has good, reliable access today. We need a public entity taking a look at just the assessment of our current broadband availability. We know that there are national security dimensions. It's in our face more and more all the time what the national security dimensions look like as it relates to broadband. And we know that we cannot create the workforce of the future if we have students out there who lack access to broadband.
Well, and I love that she talks about not marginalizing it. And I think that's the next step here when we talk about broadband and technological infrastructure, is that understanding that we work hard to get broadband access across the country, not because it's this special siloed infrastructure that everybody needs because we think it's important, although that is true, but because that infrastructure is the infrastructure of all infrastructure, right? That we need it with water monitoring, that we need it with the electrical grid to support our security, that we need it as we build the labor force for all of these infrastructures, that we need it in transportation as we increasingly look to electrical cars, and we need the infrastructure for self-driving. And so that siloing it off to the side and saying, well, it's this own thing, we have to decide how to treat it, I think she's so right. No, it's essential. It's connected, if you'll forgive the pun, to every other piece of our infrastructure, to every other piece of our functioning as a society. And so it has to be a top priority.
And it's hard to figure out what the correct public role here is because technology is moving faster than what our regulators and legislators can keep up with.
Those technologies are moving at a pace that is outperforming what policymakers can do on the regulatory and legislative side. It's even outpacing in some instances what civil society understands about these technologies and what the disproportionate impacts of these technologies could be on underserved rural communities, as well as underserved and marginalized vulnerable communities. And so I think it's important for us to not necessarily take a pause, but to think about this new society in which we live. Now we're looking at the same type of technologies which are just outperforming our wildest dreams.
So as we talk about good infrastructure citizenship, what does that mean when we talk about broadband? What does it mean for the average person? What can we do to be a good digital citizen? And sometimes I think it's important to realize that an essential component of this infrastructure is access. It often takes only one person to advocate successfully for that access.
It's a local broadband champion who really can be just your average citizen who says, you know, this is a problem in my community. You know, there's one story of a woman who she is a blueberry farmer and wanted to sell her jam online and couldn't because they didn't have a good internet connection. So that's what started this community broadband initiative in her town in Maine. So you have this person who says, you know, I really want to take this on.
So you can advocate for that access. You can, as Dr. Turner Lee advocates, just take a pause now and then on your own to consider where we are, what we're doing with technology, why it matters to everyone, to be a champion for both public and private involvement in this field, and to consider how each piece of our infrastructure intersects with others. And I think we're going to see that come up more as we start to think about childcare.
Traditionally, financial planning advice is either only for those who are already wealthy or salespeople calling themselves financial advisors who say they'll give you free financial advice but really just sell products to earn commissions. Fearless Finance takes a dramatic departure from either of those traditional models. Their entire business is built on making financial advice accessible and affordable because we know that financial literacy, stress reduction, and financial security are critical to overall well-being. I'm a little bit obsessed with Elizabeth, our Fearless Finance advisor. I've had an array of advisors in the past who answered questions like, should we be spending less on this, with evasive answers like, it depends on your priorities. Not Elizabeth. She answers with actually helpful guidelines. You're spending more than the average family of five, or I'd like to see this increase by 6%. Thank you. This is Fearless Finance's mission, to make advice affordable and accessible. You meet with your planner virtually and they charge you by the hour. You only pay for the time you use down to a quarter hour. Their planners meet with you where you are on your financial journey, no judgment. Visit fearlessfinance.com today. You can chat with a planner for free to make sure it's a good fit, and you'll get $50 off your first planning meeting when you use the code PANTSUIT. That's fearlessfinance.com and use code PANTSUIT for $50 off your first planning meeting. I recently reorganized my closet and realized that I never need to buy a white blouse or a blue dress again as long as I live. Guys, I have plenty. I did want to add some much neglected color, like pink and yellow, to my closet, and I knew just where to go. Quince always has timeless pieces and a true rainbow of options that can help you build a classic wardrobe no matter the season. It's getting warmer, so I got a soft pink chiffon pleated miniskirt that is so cute, and a really beautiful yellow cashmere tee. It's short-sleeved. It's perfect for the sort of bridge weather we're experiencing right now. And the best part is all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I absolutely love it. Get warm weather ready with Quince. Go to quince.com/pantsuit for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/pantsuit to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/pantsuit.
We're finally at my favorite time of year. Spring is here. Summer is just around the corner. We're getting our summer essentials ready. Our sunscreen, our emotional support water bottles, our steamy beach reads. But maybe you would prefer your steamy earbuds. This year, there is a new kind of essential right at your fingertips. Enemies to love. Chance encounters, a slow burn, friends that become more. Whatever your favorite romantic trope, Dipsy has a spicy audio story just for you. Dipsy is an app full of hundreds of short and spicy audio stories that bring scenarios to life with immersive soundscapes and realistic characters. You can discover stories about second chance romances and adventurous vacation flings. That's my favorite. Hot and heavy hookups. It can be as heavy or as light as you want it to be. This is what I love about Dipsy. It is a modern approach to romance through high quality, captivating audio fiction that you can listen to in the privacy of your own headphones. For listeners of the show, Dipsy is offering an extended 30-day free trial when you go to dipsystories.com/pantsuit. That's 30 days of full access for free when you go to dipsystories.com/pantsuit. That's dipsystories.com/pantsuit.
Just like with our broadband conversation, we brought in two experts to talk with us about childcare, both dear friends of ours and of the show.
My name is Anne Helen Peterson. I am a journalist, former academic, writer. I write the newsletter Culture Study, and I also write books.
My name is Savita Murthy. I'm the executive director of Tandem Partners in Early Learning. We're a small nonprofit doing big work at the intersection of social justice and early childhood education in the San Francisco Bay Area.
At the start of the show, we touched on briefly why we believe childcare should be considered part of the infrastructure conversation, but let's let Anne Helen and Savita make their case.
I mean, I think of infrastructure as like, what are the things, what are the frameworks that we need? What are the foundational supports in order to make our society work? And those don't have to be things that you yourself directly benefit from. So like adequate funding for ECE as infrastructure, even though I don't have children, because I care about our society working for everyone.
A quick break to say ECE stands for Early Childhood Education.
I believe that childcare is an issue that affects every single person in this country. Doesn't matter if you have young children, doesn't matter if you have children who are grown up in school or children who have grown up enough to have left the home, or if you don't have children. It is actually an issue that impacts every single person in America because, you know, it affects who is able to work and what they're able to do when they come to work. I feel like childcare is at that intersection of children's learning and women's earning.
So during the pandemic, we saw how clearly learning and earning intersect with one another. As anyone who has spent even a single day trying to watch young children and work at the same time knows, childcare is an absolutely critical service for the nation's productivity. This was particularly on stark display during the pandemic, when nearly 20% of working-age adults said that they couldn't work because COVID-19 disrupted their childcare arrangements. Of that, 20% of women between the ages of 25 and 44 were almost three times more likely than men not to be working specifically due to childcare issues.
And look, this has been an issue for thousands of years. Mothers have used a variety of strategies to monitor small children because while the idea that women will be wage earners outside the home is relatively new in human history, women have been working inside the home for a long time, and that worked required monitor small children and keep them safe. The strategies that have been used over the years and across cultures are amazing. Literally, like tying children to a post in the yard so they can't wander into a creek. Or I was reading about during the agricultural age, they would put cradle boxes mounted onto the actual plows and just pull the baby along with the plow.
Like so many other parts of our current social structures, major change to childcare came about during the Progressive Era. Two things happened. Women reformers advocated for day nursery. In 1898, we got the National Federation of Day Nurseries, which was the first nationwide organization devoted to this issue. We also started seeing the welfare system. And if you'll remember from long, long ago, we did an episode that is an overview of the history of welfare that we'll link here in the notes. Mothers and widows' pensions were paying women to stay home and take care of their children.
And during the Great Depression, as a part of the New Deal, the federal government established emergency nursery schools for the unemployed. And there was an attempt to scale it up when American women took manufacturing jobs during World War II. But it was largely unsuccessful. And you start to see media reports of latchkey kids that blamed selfish wage-earning mothers instead of the government for calling these women to work without providing a childcare solution.
After World War II, coming into the mid-20th century, America started to pivot from childcare infrastructure to childcare subsidies, beginning with the childcare tax deduction. This tax deduction permitted low and moderate income families, couples earning up to $4,500 per year, to deduct up to $600 for childcare from their income taxes, provided that the services were needed to permit the taxpayer to hold gainful employment.
And you see childcare advocates, almost all women, try to advocate for childcare infrastructure in addition to these subsidies. And there's some receptivity, especially in the Kennedy administration, to try to advocate for this due to what they correctly saw as a coming increase in women's employment and as a way to address racial and economic inequities. But they couldn't muster the political support. Can't imagine why when Congress was filled with men. But instead, the federal government really followed this welfare strategy and focused on low-income mothers and trying to get them into the workforce.
So we have a really messed up history reflecting the fact that the people who have been primarily doing childcare are absent from the decision-making processes and excluded from positions of power. And you see it still in our societal attitudes toward childcare because we keep talking about working outside the home as a choice. Even as more fathers are staying home with children and more households have two working parents where the burden of childcare impacts both people. I know so many couples, especially this summer, are incredibly strained. Both parents are so strained because of an absence of childcare availability. Single parents are struggling so significantly right now because everything that we would normally use in the summer to get us through until the school year is not available yet. And so hopefully the fact that labor force participation rates of mothers with children under 18 was 72.3% in 2019 will get us motivated to do what we need to do.
But despite those labor statistics, our attitudes on this issue could not be farther from the reality that an overwhelming majority of mothers work.
There was a 2019 Pew Research survey that came out which said that 21% of U.S. adults said that it was best for women with young children to stay home. 42% said it was best for them to work part-time. And only 33% said it was best for a mom to work full time. When my son was a baby, I've had like personal experience of it. And this was like 2016. I was in my 40s. And the number of people that I encountered who just expected me to stay home because he was a baby was ridiculous. And not that there's like anything wrong with women staying at home. But I feel like that choice has to be the woman's choice to make. It cannot be a choice that's imposed upon the woman, either the mom or the dad. It cannot be a choice that's imposed because, you know, there are systemic structures at play.
So again, that trend of it's difficult to even quantify the infrastructure problem. We know that we don't have an entirely accurate understanding of the labor force. We also still don't have a good vision of what childcare infrastructure should look like. And we continue to have that sort of Nixon era fear mongering in our heads. When he vetoed a child care bill, President Nixon said that bipartisan child care legislation could create a communal approach to child rearing And in his view, that was a detrimental thing.
I think that there is this understanding that like somehow it's going to be like this dark Soviet vision of like group housing for babies. Like all the babies have to nap in like matching beds that go on for miles. Right? And that is so not what ECE experts and policy proponents are actually envisioning. What they really want, and I've heard this on so many different fronts, is just an incredibly hybrid model because kids need and parents need all different types of care. Some kids who need like 24-hour care or care that is happening at night as well because their parents work a night shift and they're a single parent and they can't find someone. And if we have work that has to go on at night, we need someone to be able to offer that care. Some people need, you know, the very like 3 hours, 3 days a week, that style. Some people need 6 to 6. Some people need 9 to 2. Like there are just so many different modes.
So the history is challenging enough, but the reality on the ground feels almost impossible to so many families. Finding childcare that can meet a regular Monday through Friday 9-to-5 job is incredibly difficult. Now, if you need hours outside that regular Monday through Friday 9-to-5 situation, then you've really got your work cut out for you because that's going to be even more difficult.
According to the Center for American Progress, nearly half of the childcare supply in the country, roughly 4.5 million slots, may be closed permanently as a result of the pandemic. There are more than 4 children under 3 per each licensed childcare slot. Think about that. For every slot we have available in licensed childcare, there are 4 kids under 3 years old who need that spot. Basically, we have enough licensed childcare to serve 23% of infants and toddlers. That's 3 times more scarce than it is for children who are 3 to 5.
And it's scarce for children 3 to 5, and it was scarce before the pandemic. So after the pandemic, it's even worse. More than 80% of the counties in that study qualified as childcare deserts, where there are 3 or more children per licensed childcare slot.
And we know that all of us, to some extent, just have to navigate this patchwork of care that you borrow a little time here, you lean on a friend there. So many families where a parent stays at home become just this vital catch-all in their neighborhoods. You know, the people who are willing to step up when that patchwork fails. When I was working full-time in an office, especially when my husband was traveling for work, I always described our situation as like a Jenga tower, where if you moved too many pieces at one time, everything started to fall down because we don't have family locally. And so our backup options start to run out very quickly. And we navigate that Jenga tower with a whole lot of resources behind us and a whole lot of community around us and 2 parents. That puts us in an easier situation than lots of people are navigating.
It's so broken. We have 2 working people in my home with highly flexible schedules. I have my parents who live up the street, one whom is retired, and one who also has a flexible schedule, and childcare is still a perpetual stressor for me. I cannot fathom how people without resources make this work.
So we have this system with diverse needs in terms of hours, not to even get into the diverse needs that children have for how they need to be supported during their days. We have really limited access to licensed providers. The one consistent across the board is that childcare is expensive, and it is so hard to understand why. So we ask Savitha and Ann Helen to help us understand why parents are paying so much for childcare and childcare providers are still operating at these razor-thin margins.
A lot of it has to do with the student-to-teacher ratios or with the child-to-teacher ratios, because when you're working with children under 5, you have to have the number of adults in relation to the number of children is actually quite high. And the number of adults you need in relation to the number of children increases the younger the children. This is why infant childcare is so hard to find. I mean, the cost is huge for a childcare provider, because you have to have like quite a few adults employed for not that many slots. So most childcare providers don't have any kind of like financial cushion. And so when they have to deal with any kind of catastrophe, like a global pandemic, for example, then they don't have any kind of like financial resource to weather those kinds of storms and those kinds of like really catastrophic kind of situations. So that's the big problem. So we're in the situation of like for the average American, childcare is cripplingly expensive. And then for the provider, it's so hard to run a high quality, viable, sustainable small business is also such a huge challenge.
With our current understanding of what safe childcare looks like, which is talking about the regulations that are in place in terms of how many teachers need to be with how many kids, right? Our ratios. That is a market failure, right? It is too expensive. And just as, you know, a handful of families in your neighborhood would really struggle to pay the salary of a first grade teacher and a fourth grade teacher, right? If you were just paying for that on your own, and also the space in which that first grade classroom takes place, and also all of the supplies and all of the edification that comes from like PE teachers and music teachers, this sort of thing. And so if middle-class people can't pay a living wage for people to work in these care centers, then what can poor people do, right? And if we think of care as a necessity in order for people to be part of the marketplace, then who's going to provide this care? And the solution that we currently have in place is that we pay the people doing this work very little, and then they rely on government subsidies in order to get by. Why don't we just use that money to pay the workers more? Why don't we actually create the infrastructure to make this a sustainable enterprise?
You know, as I listen to both of them, I think, is expensive even the right word? Should we just say completely unaffordable? I mean, infant childcare costs, on average, $11,000 annually. That's more than the price of public college in 33 states. I think we've zoomed right past discussions of affordability when the numbers get that high. And what is so incredibly frustrating, angering, enraging to think about is that as expensive as childcare is, that many of the people, mostly women, doing the actual work of caring for our children are still severely underpaid.
Childcare workers are so poorly paid. Like if you compare salaries for the average childcare worker with salaries for their counterparts in K-12, I'm not by any means suggesting that teachers are well paid. Teachers in the K-12 system should also be paid more. But a few years ago, the average was something like $11 an hour or thereabouts. And so then it creates this nexus of we're not valuing it sufficiently as a profession. And so that creates some inequities in terms of like who gets employed in the childcare sector. We talk about childcare and high quality early learning as being a huge lever for addressing and ameliorating poverty. We cannot expect our preschool teachers to do the work of ameliorating poverty, even as they're living in it themselves. So we want preschool teachers to earn at least as much as K-12 teachers. And I think, you know, right now, a majority of preschool teachers are low-income women of color. Only 15% of them are receiving employer-sponsored health insurance. And depending on which state they're in, nearly half of them are relying on some form of public assistance. We've got to really think about this as the workforce that is educating the future generation of our country. And I think we've got to value that workforce. That's where I would direct the Biden administration's attention.
The whole problem here is that the work of caring for children does not scale. We pay a huge premium for other types of labor requiring unique skills, and we take for granted the unique, vital skills that caregivers bring to our society. When we're undervaluing our childcare workers, we're creating high rates of burnout and high rates of turnover. High rates of turnover are not good for children. They are not good for employers. They are not good for families.
Yet when my son Felix went to Head Start, they talked to us about how they try to keep the children at Head Start with the same teacher all 3 years because changing teachers is seen as like a childhood trauma. And I thought, oh my gosh, that's incredible because they have difficulty keeping teachers there because of the turnover. And look, it doesn't take rocket science to figure out why we undervalue this work. It's because it's done by women. And I don't think it's just because it's done by women. I think it's done by women for children because we talk a big game about kids in this country, but we don't put our money where our mouth is. And I think it is infuriating that this essential, important, truly like life-giving and life-building work is not paid what it is deserved.
Throughout this series, we've been talking about jobs. We want infrastructure to create jobs because jobs are like a golden standard for any political policy's success. A big missing piece is whether anyone who has to take care of another person is going to have access to think about new jobs. Mm-hmm. We have this huge problem of trying to get people back to work, and childcare is the missing piece.
A lot of women who would otherwise be on the job market, be looking for work, don't have the ability to because low-cost care is not accessible to them. So many caregiving centers, especially lower-cost ones, shut down during the pandemic. So where do you find that care? How do you cobble it together? Why would you do that? Why would you work that hard to get paid $12 an hour? It's not worth the cost-benefit analysis.
Not to mention, it gives people jobs. It allows people to work. It creates industry. It's such a win-win on so many levels. Okay, so where does all that leave us? Can we officially classify childcare as infrastructure? And why does that even matter?
I think we are going to have a really difficult time formulating something like the electrical grid around childcare. And I don't think that's the goal. And to me, this is the trouble. I don't think the debate about whether to call it infrastructure is the actual debate, right? I think the trouble is when we hear childcare and federal policy and infrastructure together, we start to think, is childcare going to be delivered like water coming from a faucet, where we all have exactly the same thing, take it or leave it, this is how it's done. In my mind, though, a country that is capable of delivering drinking water to our toilets all day, every day, and the miraculous thought and science and work behind that, a country that's capable of that can figure out the challenge of meeting families and children where they are and finding a way to take this thing that right now is priced like a luxury good, despite it being essential to our lives. I think we can meet the challenge of figuring out how to do this.
Well, and it just feels like infrastructure because infrastructure is always about short-term pain for long-term gain. It's always about investing now for the future later. And that's what we're doing because right now it's not just inefficient for the families the way that we're doing. It's inefficient for all of us. If you never pay for childcare, believe it's affecting you. And that's what infrastructure is about, right? Like helping people see the interconnected nature of the foundation upon which we build our society and our economy affects everybody, and so everybody needs to pitch in. And that could not be more true for childcare because, again, we're investing right now just further down the pipeline.
I think that's a struggle, right? I think that we also are just so reticent to fund things that are preventative, right? Like maintenance, we're like, oh, wait till it breaks and then fix it. And this is true in the way that we think of care too. We're like, oh, there's like all of these things that we can very clearly trace back to learning styles and environments when kids are between the ages of 1 and 5. So many different things. But instead of actually trying to ameliorate those conditions and try to create learning and situations that are nurturing and safe and encourage creativity, experimentation. Like instead we're like, oh, well, let's just like incarcerate people. Let's try to jerry-rig a backwards solution.
Wherever you are on this issue, We're hopeful that we can all recognize the ripple effects created by inadequate childcare in our society and in our economy, and at least start to open better conversations about it.
If I were in charge of presenting this issue to the American public, I would say this is about the next generation. This is about the future of our country. It's the future of our world. Thinking about it as an issue of infrastructure locates it in the present. And thinking about it as, you know, the next generation of Americans helps us tell a powerful future story.
Listen, y'all, let's be serious. I'm 42 years old. Of course, I take my skincare routine seriously. There are a lot of daily skincare products on the market claiming to help reduce fine lines and wrinkles, but how do you know your products are actually working? Well, Ritual is here for you. They have Hyacera, their once daily skin supplement, clinically proven to reduce wrinkles and fine lines and increase skin smoothness in 90 days. They conducted a clinical study and it led to a 3.6 times reduction in crow's feet within 90 days as compared to a placebo and a 2.9 times increase in skin smoothness within 90 days as compared to a placebo. I love taking my Hyacera every day as part of my skincare routine instead of just slathering more products on my face. It feels like I'm doing something from the inside out. And their one daily capsule is essenced with soothing vanilla, so it's a very pleasant experience. Start Hyacera to help minimize wrinkles without compromising on clean science. Hyacera from Ritual is a clinically proven skin supplement you can actually trust. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/pantsuit. Start Ritual or add Hyacera to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/pantsuit for 25% off.
Spring is so tricky because I feel the sun shining, the earth is waking up, and I want fresh, vegetable-forward meals. And I'm running in 75 directions and don't have a lot of kitchen and prep time. Fortunately, Factor is here for me and for you with fresh, never-frozen meals that are chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in 2 minutes. They have a ton of options for us, including keto, protein plus, vegan, veggie, calorie smart, and so many add-ons. If you need help with breakfast or snacks or on-the-go lunches or beverages, Factor is here for you. Every meal I've had from Factor is so well composed, it's so flavorful, the sauces are delicious, and Factor is celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look for Earth Month Eats badges on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals. Head to factormeals.com/pantsuit50 and use code pantsuit50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code PANTSUIT50 at factormeals.com/PANTSUIT50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Do you want a bra that's sexy or a bra that's comfortable? Thanks to Third Love, you can have both. Third Love was started to take all the frustration, ick, and ugh out of bra shopping. That's why they made solutions for every bra problem, aka problems. Their bras make it easy to bring back perkiness you haven't seen since high school, get smoothing you know where, and have straps that actually stay put. Designed at their headquarters in San Francisco and made from premium materials, they put every style through hours of wear testing on real women, including themselves, before it's given the stamp of boob approval. Comfort and support are guaranteed. Plus, whether you're a AA cup or an H cup, their virtual fitting room will help you find your perfect fit fast. They even invented half cups. No more feeling stuck between two cup sizes that don't fit. It's time to get your problem solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get 15% off your order with code PODCAST15.
Both broadband and childcare really highlight this turning point in history. We have the opportunity to level the playing field for Americans in so many real ways. Where we put our dollars will have generational impact, and both of these issues are vital to the continued success of everyone in our nation. And we hope that's been evident, not just in this episode, but throughout this whole series.
We also hope that that theme of equity throughout this series is really landing, that since the beginning of infrastructure, you know, we have been focused on infrastructure as an equalizing force that everyone has access to the post office, not just the cities, that everyone needs running water, that everyone needs electricity, that everyone needs reliable broadband and reliable childcare. And again, this is why I see infrastructure as such an expression of care. It is our way of showing that we believe everyone gets baseline things to help them navigate their lives. Equity is a vital part of this conversation because it perfectly represents how we're bound together. And that access to quality infrastructure for one person benefits everyone.
So let's ensure that we're prioritizing equity. As we look to refurbish the systems of the past, improve the systems of the present, and innovate the systems of the future.
I think it's important if society is going to move in that direction that we need to make sure that it's equitable. And making it equitable means being able to have infrastructure in place so that people can access it just like they do electricity and water, but also making sure, to our point, that people understand what these critical infrastructures mean for their everyday lives. You can't drive a highway without a car. And in the same way, you can't get on broadband without a device. And so I think it's important for us to not necessarily take a pause, but to think about this new society in which we live. We've always known that it was coming. I mean, come on now. We put a man and a woman in outer space. Now we're looking at the same type of technologies which are just outperforming our wildest dreams.
We're so grateful that you joined us for this journey through infrastructure in real life. We know that we have only scratched the surface of these topics, and we'll keep having these conversations on the show as we return to our regular format next week. But we really hope that this has been educational. We hope it's been encouraging, and we hope that you're ready to do the work on making the infrastructure in this country the best it can be.
And we hope that you've spent time thinking about how to be a good infrastructure citizen. How to advocate for infrastructure in your own community. How to just see the infrastructure in your own life. That's what we hope we've done throughout this series. That's what we hope to continue to do here at Pantsuit Politics. Thank you so much for joining us for Infrastructure in Real Life. There is tons of extended bonus content on our premium channels, both on Apple Podcasts and Patreon. We will be back again with you next week. And until then, keep it nuanced, y'all. Infrastructure in Real Life was produced by Studio D Podcast Productions. Elise Knapp is our managing director. Megan Hart is our community engagement manager.
Special thanks to every expert who spoke to us for this series and our series contributors, Alyssa Maxwell, Monty Lawson, Courtney Verclair, and Jordan Bond.
Braid Creative and Kathleen Shannon put together the very cool, groovy graphics for this series. You can purchase a companion book box for the series and join our extra credit book club through Wild Geese Bookshop.
Our show is listener-supported. Special thanks to our executive producers.
Martha Brunitsky.
Linda Daniel.
Hallie Edwards.
Janice Elliott.
Sarah Greenup.
Julie Haller.
Helen Handley.
Tiffany Hassler.
Barry Kaufman.
Molly Kors.
The Creeps!
Lori Ladau.
Lily McClure.
David McWilliams.
Jared Minson.
Emily Neasley.
The Hesitants!
Tawny Peterson.
Tracy Putoff.
Sarah Ralph.
Jeremy Sequoia.
Karen True.
Amy Whited.
Joshua Allen. Morgan McHugh. Nicole Berkless. Paula Bremer. And Tim Miller.
To support Pantsuit Politics and receive lots of bonus features, visit patreon.com/pantsuitpolitics.
You can also connect with us on our website, pantsuitpoliticsshow.com. Sign up for our weekly newsletter and follow us on Instagram at Pantsuit Politics.
Oh, no problem. Yeah, I hope it was helpful. I was trying to give you a lot of sound bites. I'm kind of preachy on this stuff because I feel like so strongly about it, you know?
Well, you know what? But, speaking of broadband, my internet connection has become unstable. Ugh.
We're sorry. You have reached a number that has been disconnected or is no longer in service.
Oh, okay. So this is from Sarah's notes. Sorry, I'm actually looking at it on my screen now. I will figure out what in the world she's talking about there.
Because I am having a week and really want to die right now. Thank God for transcripts that made this so much easier. Okay, y'all tell me if you think this is cheesy or not.
Yeah, I love that idea.
It's because it's what makes me so mad. I'm not going to cry though. Hold on.
You can cry if you need to cry, Sarah. People love it
no,
when
I'm
you
not
cry.
Gonna cry.
Don't let those haters get you down.
Not in this series. Okay.
Let me do that again because somebody just slammed a door. So we
child
have
care.
Child care.
That's the cut. Perfect. Ah. Good job, whoever slammed the door in Beth's house.
It's fine.